From the studios of the Mayo Clinic News Network, this is Mayo Clinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
February is American Heart Month, celebrated each year to raise awareness of heart health and heart disease.
On today's program, we'll discuss women's heart health and the connections between the heart and autoimmune diseases with a Mayo Clinic expert.
And started looking into this deeper, and what we know is that the process of plaque building up in the heart arteries, or atherosclerosis, yes, it's about cholesterol, blood pressure, and all of those things, but there's also a link to inflammation.
Also on the program, the latest research on medical management versus surgery for heart disease. And what are the common health risks after surviving breast cancer?
All that, along with a Health Minute from Vivian Williams, right after this.
Heart disease, it's still the number one killer of women in this country. In fact, ever since 1984, more women have died of heart disease than men.
Amazing.
Today on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll talk with a women's health expert, Dr. Rekha Mankad. We'll find out if women have become more aware of their risk for heart disease in the past few years.
We're going to talk about how the symptoms of heart disease are different in women than men and get her advice on how women can lead heart-healthy lives. Plus, we'll learn about the increased risk of heart disease and stroke for patients with rheumatoid arthritis and other autoimmune diseases. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Rekha Mankad.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Dr. Mankad, are we doing better? Are more women recognizing the fact that heart disease is the disease that's most likely to kill them?
Yes, we are actually doing better. And in the last few years, the mortality rates for women with heart disease have dropped quite a bit. So actually, the number of women dying of heart disease compared to men dying of heart disease is actually pretty equal now.
Okay, so I was wrong. Aren't you women glad to hear that?
Well, I mean, when you look at that figure, that 1984, that's a long time that women went basically not even considering that they could have heart disease or die of heart attack. That is still impressive to me.
And it's true. And we have to remember that although I say that the numbers are equal as far as the number of people dying, we have to remember that heart disease is still less prevalent in women. So it still is more prevalent in men, meaning that it's more likely that a man is going to have heart disease. So when you look at the number of deaths, it still is important to recognize that in a disease that's less prevalent in women, we have equal numbers of deaths. So it is very important to recognize. But yeah, there was a period of time where no woman had any idea that the thing she was going to die of was actually heart disease.
She was more worried about breast cancer.
Absolutely.
So why is it that heart disease is more prevalent in men? I know there is some protective of hormonal effect and up until menopause, and then things start to equal out, don't they?
That's exactly true. So in younger women, so those who are premenopausal, the likelihood of having traditional coronary artery disease or plaque building up in the arteries.
The arteries that supply the heart muscle.
Mm-hmm. You're right. That's less common. And you're right. Estrogen actually protects women from having that process develop. But as soon as a woman reaches her mid-50s, the occurrence of heart disease sort of skyrockets. And essentially, it equals that of men within sort of 5 years after menopause.
But there are also some barriers to women receiving excellent care for heart disease, aren't there?
Yeah, I think there still is this gap of knowledge of the recognition of heart disease being an important risk factor for women's symptoms and signs. So I think there's always that delay in diagnosis that we see, especially in younger women. I think both providers and patients continue to say, well, yes, I understand that heart disease is the number one killer of women, but that's not going to happen to me personally.
Sure.
So individually, they don't recognize the risk, even though they may know the statistics.
Recent article, and I read this, and I have the quote here, sort of amazing to me. Studies show women having heart attacks wait more than 30% longer than men to go to the ER and experience a 20% longer wait time than men. True?
Yeah, that's what we see. I mean, I think, again, it's very dependent on where you go and how experienced a center might be dealing with, you know, women and heart disease. But yeah, I think certainly the wait time for women continue to think it's something else before they'll call an ambulance or ask to be taken in. And that sort of segues into the fact that the symptoms are a little bit less classic for women. So they think it's their stomach or they, you know, something they ate, something other than heart disease is what sort of drives them. And usually it's only after they talk to someone or they realize the symptoms aren't going away that they go, I better go get checked out.
But well, they make their husband go right away.
Well, that's because men in general have the crushing, you know, weight on the chest type thing.
Elephant and for, sitting on the chest.
Yeah, and for women, it's, I feel like I'm going to throw up, or I just feel clammy and gross. I don't really quite feel right. I mean, that can cover a whole lot of experiences. Food poisoning.
Yeah. They're non-specific symptoms, but we have to recognize that chest pain is actually one of the symptoms. It's a fairly common symptom, but it's not the predominant or only symptom. And it usually is not as severe. And it's associated with shortness of breath, nausea, feeling of unease. The pain may be in the back or limited to the shoulders. So it is different. And I think that's why there is this a delay or maybe even confusion that develops. Like, is this really my heart? Should it be, you know, should I get it checked out or not?
Fatigue, shortness of breath are the two most common symptoms of heart attack in women.
Is highly prevalent. They're not the most common. Chest pain is still the most common symptom, but it is sort of in with all these other symptoms. So it's not the only symptom.
All right. Are there unusual kinds of heart attacks in women that that the women in this audience ought to be concerned about, ought to know about?
Yeah. So there is a condition called spontaneous coronary artery dissection. So it's a heart attack that happens in young women. So these are typically the premenopausal women, although the range can be fairly broad as far as ages. And this is a woman who doesn't have the regular risk factors for that plaque that builds up in heart arteries. And what this condition is a tear of the heart artery. So it decreases blood flow just like a regular heart attack does, but the reasons for it isn't due to a plaque that's rupturing. It's a tear in the artery. And that, again, happens in very young women. It can happen in 20 and 30-year-old women. So clearly not something that they are recognizing that could happen to them.
Is chest pain the most common symptom?
It is. Chest pain is the most common symptom.
We have any idea why this happens?
We know that there's a link between this condition and another condition called fibromuscular dysplasia. So both of these conditions show that the vessel wall is friable, or at least it's something about that vessel wall
fragile,
is abnormal. Huh? Yeah, it's fragile. We don't know why. These tend to happen. These events happen during periods of extreme emotion or physical activity. So we've had women who had just gone out for a run, a really long run, or in a very heated argument, and they can have these episodes. And again, when a 20 or 30-year-old is going into the hospital with chest pain, the last thing most people are thinking of is that it's a heart attack.
But I assume if you get there in time, it's fixable?
Yeah, it's very different than a regular heart attack because this tear in the artery can actually heal itself. So first of all, you have to have a high index of suspicion to know that this might be the reason that that patient's having the heart attack. So you do an angiogram like you would for any other heart attack.
That's the dye test where you can actually see the tear in the artery.
Correct. But again, you have to have a high index of suspicion because if the artery is torn but things look good, it might be better not to do anything to that artery like a stent procedure.
What about all of the other things that you're supposed to do for good heart health?
Yeah, let's talk about prevention.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because if you told me what my heart numbers were, if I could remember them, that would be another thing. But how important is it to know what your numbers are and to know your cholesterol and those different things?
Yeah, it's really important. You know, I think everybody needs to take ownership of their own health. So understanding what high blood pressure is or normal blood pressure, I think, is very important. Now, high blood pressure doesn't give you a symptom. So you'll only know if that's abnormal if you go in and get regular checkups to see if your blood pressure is elevated. Cholesterol numbers should be checked in your young adulthood and then repeated at certain intervals after that. So those are really important things to be able to have checked and to be able to follow to see how your risk changes over your lifetime.
What do you think about the new blood pressure guidelines? Aren't they a little bit strict, 120 over 80 or less? I mean, you know, there are not that many people who are in that range, are there?
There are people that are in that range, and it sounds strict, but if you look at the data, I mean, that's where the benefit is to have those lower numbers. As soon as that number, the top number, gets above 120, you start increasing your risk of heart attack and stroke. And we had thought, well, maybe we don't need to be that stringent, but the most recent documents and the guidelines have suggested that if you really want to be an optimal health, that blood pressure be less than 120 over 80.
Now, before I went to medical school, my mom always told me that the systolic number, she had high blood pressure, that her doctor explained to her that as long as it was 120 plus your age, you were okay. Yeah, I mean, that was a while ago, but that's what we used to think, and we've learned a great deal since then.
Quite a bit, and we have to be careful because as you get older, your blood pressure, I mean, it's much more common to have high blood pressure as we all get older. But even in the elderly, being stricter with blood pressure does have benefit.
All right. So blood pressure is important. Obviously, smoking is the first thing that women and men ought to do to protect their heart health.
Absolutely.
Okay. What about cholesterol? Is that as important as we have thought?
Yeah, it is important, and it remains something that we as cardiologists follow very closely. I think we do know it's more complex than the number by itself, so you have to take that into context with other risk factors. We know people can have high cholesterol and never have a cardiac event, and it's because of the makeup of that cholesterol is just healthier for that person. So, as an isolated number, you have to be careful, but you take it in context with other risk factors as well. But certain people who have really high bad cholesterol, that's the LDL cholesterol, if it's really high, they could have a condition called familial hypercholesterolemia. Those people are at very high risk for cardiovascular or cerebrovascular events.
But drugs work to lower that.
Yes, they do.
And we know that you should lose weight and get active. What about sleep? Is sleep important for heart health?
Sleep is very important for heart health because that's when we sort of reset. That's when we rejuvenate. So if we don't get enough sleep, and that does vary by person, every person's a little bit different, but we're looking at somewhere to 6 to 8 hours of sleep at night, and that's restful sleep. It really is a benefit for your heart health.
All right. What's your favorite diet for heart health?
So the Mediterranean diet is a really good diet and one that I think is achievable. But I will tell you that the recent literature is really sort of going towards a purely plant-based
vegetarian diet.
Yeah.
I knew that she was going to say that.
Tell us about the Mediterranean diet. What's the difference between a plant-based diet and the Mediterranean diet?
So the Mediterranean diet allows for fish. So that's the big difference. I mean, the plant-based diet, it's no animal proteins at all.
Chickens?
In the plant-based,
no.
It's all plant.
But the Mediterranean chicken?
It's not that you can't have it, but they tell you that where you should strive to get your protein is in fish or in legumes. So, lentils and things like that is the best place to get your protein source.
All right. And get active. Exercise, really important. It can certainly reduce your risk of heart disease.
Yeah. Exercise is very important.
Anything else we missed?
Diabetes is another risk factor for heart disease.
So, huge risk factors. Right. Is it true that half of the people, 50% or more of the people who go into the emergency room with a heart attack have diabetes?
I'm not sure it's quite that high,
but it's
quite high. And it might not be full-blown diabetes, but it might be early diabetes or glucose intolerance, we would say, where the blood sugar is elevated but not in the criteria of diabetes. And that's important, and that goes along with a condition called metabolic syndrome, where you have an elevated blood pressure, some bad cholesterol numbers, and elevated blood sugar, and carry that fat in your middle, the spare tire, we say.
All right, so you got to know your blood pressure, you got to know your cholesterol, keep your weight down. Did I miss anything?
Exercise,
don't smoke. Yep. And don't smoke. Yeah, that's probably the most important one. Now, in addition to being a women's heart health expert, Dr. Rekha Mankad is also director of the Cardiorheumatology Clinic at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. Even I didn't know there was such a thing.
Well, we did an interview with a cardio-oncologist, so cancer and our heart. So what about rheumatology and our heart? What is this? What's the link?
So I'll sort of give you some historical details first. Actually, this has been identified in the rheumatology literature for decades, where patients with specifically rheumatoid arthritis and lupus were noted to have more heart disease risk than patients without those conditions. So that had been reported in epidemiologic studies for years, but nobody had really talked about it. So I actually just accidentally happened upon this when I was sent a patient by one of the rheumatologists, and I thought, why are they sending me a patient with rheumatoid arthritis to assess their heart? And then I started looking at the literature, and I thought, wow, there is a link, and started looking into this deeper. And what we know is that the process of plaque building up in the heart arteries, or atherosclerosis, yes, it's about cholesterol, blood pressure, and all of those things, but there's also a link to inflammation. And we see that that process of plaque building up in the arteries, actually inflammation can get that plaque to get started and to progress. And this is why, just as cardiologists, we do check inflammatory markers frequently when we're evaluating somebody's heart disease risk, and that blood test is called a C-reactive protein. So patients with rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, and many of the others, those are all inflammatory autoimmune conditions. So it makes sense why these patients have increased risk of heart disease. They have a constant elevated level of inflammation. It might be all the time, or it might just happen in flares. And there's been a lot of studies done looking at the link between these conditions.
Well, when I first heard it, it makes sense to me that if you've got lupus or fibromyalgia or arthritis, that you're not as active as you could be or should be. Mm-hmm. And so that would be the reason why you have heart disease, but that's not it. It just, I would imagine it contributes though.
Yes, it does. And that's a very important contribution, because patients with those conditions do tend to be less physically active. And therefore they sort of augment their risk. So they already have the risk related to their condition by itself. And then that risk can be further enhanced because they're less active. By being less active, they may be more overweight. By being more overweight and less active, their blood pressure may be higher and their cholesterol may be more abnormal. So all of those do tie in. But the disease itself has an independent risk.
Remind our audience again what we mean when we talk about an autoimmune disease.
So these are diseases where your own body sort of is destroying tissue. So there is antibodies that for some reason develop and destroys tissue. For rheumatoid arthritis, the symptoms are typically in the joints. So most of the symptoms are in the joints, and that's where the inflammation is sort of visibly, we see it attacking. But that inflammation is seen throughout the body, and that's why the heart is affected. And in lupus, multiple organs can be involved in that condition as well. So in all of these rheumatologic conditions, there's psoriatic arthritis, there's systemic sclerosis, there's many of them. And they've all been looked at, and they all appear to have this increased risk for heart disease.
So what should patients, and I'm sure you counsel them on this, if they've got some sort of disease, that whole spectrum of rheumatologic diseases, what can they do to prevent heart disease?
Well, I think the first thing is education. So they need to understand that this risk exists, and they should talk with their physicians about ways to become more heart healthy. I do see a lot of patients with these conditions, and one of the mainstays that I do is discuss the link between the diseases, and then we look at the things we can fix. So we look at the cholesterol, we look at the blood pressure, we talk about ways to get more aerobically fit and healthier in general with diet and exercise, and then we talk about ways that the actual disease can also be modified. So if the disease isn't under control and they have more inflammation, I need to talk to my rheumatology colleagues about how to get that inflammation under better control. So the combination of things needs to take place to decrease their risk.
Do they need to be screened periodically, patients with rheumatologic diseases?
Well, so we don't have any guidelines, I'll tell you that, although the most recent guidelines for the prevention of heart disease did include rheumatologic autoimmune inflammatory conditions as an at-risk group. And then actually it's called a risk enhancer. So if you have one of those conditions, you sort of look at the big picture with that patient and say, well, their risk is going to be higher by having that condition. But we don't really know, should we be evaluating them every couple of years or every 5 years? We don't know. What I typically do is when I get sent to patients, usually because they have some other traditional risk factor for heart disease. So the combination of the rheumatologic condition plus a traditional risk factor elevates it enough that typically the rheumatologists want me to weigh in on ways to improve that risk profile.
Oh, nice. Mayo Clinic Heart Specialist, Director of the Cardiorheumatology Clinic, Dr. Rekha Mankad. Cardiovascular diseases are indeed women's greatest health threat, and more women in America are realizing that.
And if you suffer from rheumatologic disease, you are at an increased risk for heart disease. Thanks for joining us to talk about both topics today.
Thank you very much.
Still to come on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll discuss the ischemia trial, the latest research on using medications instead of surgery for treating heart disease.
And what health risks are a concern for breast cancer survivors.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams for the Mayo Clinic News Network. The Food and Drug Administration has approved a drug derived from fish oil for some patients with elevated triglyceride levels to reduce the risk of heart attack, stroke, and other cardiovascular events. The drug contains a certain type of omega-3 fatty acid and can be used as an add-on therapy for people on a statin. So does this mean you should take fish oil supplements? Does fish oil really help reduce your risk of heart disease? Well, yes, says cardiologist Dr. Stephen Kopetsky. He says first, you probably ought to eat about 6 ounces of fish, such as salmon or mackerel, 3 times a week. Almost a pound of fish a week would be the ideal, but most people don't do that. Now, fish oil is a source of omega-3 fatty acids, which are essential for muscle function, including that of your heart. Omega-3s help reduce the risk of heart attacks, high triglycerides, and high blood pressure. Dr. Kopetsky says that people who have high cholesterol and triglycerides over 200 and people who are vegan or don't eat fish should consider taking omega-3 supplements. He says a pill doesn't take the place of a healthy lifestyle. It has to be in addition to it. He says taking an omega-3 supplement plus regular exercise, not smoking, getting sufficient sleep, eating at least 5 servings of fruits and veggies a day, and if you can, eating fatty fish, such as, again, salmon or mackerel, can improve your heart health. If you can do a little bit over time, it's been shown to help tremendously, says Dr. Kopetsky. And in other news, we're going to get a little techie here and talk about robots. Now, bronchoscopy is a procedure that lets doctors examine your lungs, treat conditions, and biopsy nodules to check for cancer. Doctors at Mayo Clinic are using robotic assistants to make the procedure more precise. Dr. Karen Swanson, a Mayo Clinic pulmonologist, says they're using gaming controllers to drive the robotic-assisted bronchoscope. With this scope, she can see inside a patient's lungs and biopsy a worrisome nodule. Biopsying these nodules is important to get a diagnosis, she says. Robotic scopes are smaller and more flexible than standard scopes. They also provide better vision. She says technology allows them to see things in the airways that they've never seen before. And because the scope has never been able to get there before with good optics, the technology helps doctors be more precise, and it allows them to get bigger tissue samples to assess tumor type. Knowing tumor type allows them to tailor treatment for each individual patient. Robotic-assisted bronchoscopy also may lead to new, less invasive ways to treat lung tumors. For the Mayo Clinic News Network, I'm Vivian Williams.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Well, there's new evidence that patients with stable CAD, that's coronary artery disease, and we'll explain a little bit more about that momentarily. Patients with stable CAD may be managed without stents or without a CABG, a coronary artery bypass grafting. And that is to say that optimal medical therapy alone may be the best option for patients with stable angina, that is mild chest pain as the result of CAD or coronary artery disease.
Here to talk to us about the latest findings is Mayo Clinic cardiologist, that's a heart specialist, Dr. Todd Miller. Welcome to the program. It's good to see you.
Thank you, Tracy.
So, Dr. Miller, they called this the ischemia trial. So explain that term and also what we mean by the term angina and coronary artery disease.
Well, let's start first with coronary artery disease. So beginning around age 20, based on autopsy studies from soldiers from Korea and the Vietnam Wars, it was known that plaque development starts at that age in people who live in the United States.
That's crud inside the artery.
Crud inside the artery. And it first starts out as a little fat deposition in the artery, and you would not be able to detect that with any of our current techniques. But over time, that fat buildup continues, and then it can start to calcify. And once it starts to calcify, we have methods now where you can image that and see the plaque buildup developing. So for men who are 50, men are usually developing this process at a more rapid rate than women. When men are 50, about half the men in the country will have detectable plaque buildup.
And is this whole process called atherosclerosis?
This is called atherosclerosis, hardening of the arteries, if you will. And once you start to develop enough plaque so that it blocks up the vessel, occludes the vessel by 50 to 70%, then you start to impair blood flow. So that's where the term ischemia comes from. So you don't impair blood flow at rest when you're 50 to 70% narrowed, but with exertion and exercise, you would start to impair blood flow with that type of narrowing.
The formal term for coronary artery disease would be if you have 50 to 70% blockage of the artery.
Then it's defined as clinically significant coronary artery disease.
Would that be in all three? Are there three main arteries, coronary arteries, or could it be just one?
It could be just one.
So tell us about the study, the ischemia study.
Right. So as background for this study, this type of study has been performed for several years, going back 50 years. And the initial trials compared just medical therapy to bypass surgery. And around the 1970s, seven large studies were performed, and they showed very little evidence that bypass either improves survival or reduces heart attack risk compared to medical therapy alone. So this concept that trying to fix the arteries by revascularizing them, doing bypass, has been around for a long time, and in the chronic setting, it's been difficult to show that you can improve longevity or reduce heart attack risk. There were certain subsets of patients with the worst plaque who had a little bit of benefit. And then following that, we've had half a dozen previous studies that used just stents alone compared to medical therapy. And also, those studies reached a similar conclusion, where it was hard to show that longevity or heart attack risk were improved by doing stents. So the dilemma was, people criticize those studies because in many of those studies, even though patients had blockages, they may not have had the impairment to blood flow, the ischemia. And it's been known from a lot of other studies that ischemia is a marker of patients who are at highest risk. So if you can demonstrate ischemia, which you can do with stress tests, you can show impaired blood flow and those patients are at higher risk. And so the ischemia trial was specifically designed to recruit patients who had significant ischemia on their stress test. That's the differing part of it from prior studies.
Ischemia, lack of blood flow.
Lack of blood flow.
To the heart muscle.
And not just a little bit. They had to have substantial ischemia. More than 10% of the heart muscle had to have impaired blood flow.
Okay.
So they tried to recruit the highest risk patients to see it in this high risk group, would stents improve outcome.
And how many patients did you have?
Worldwide, there were over 5,000, so this is by far the biggest study of coronary artery disease with an intervention ever performed. Previous studies, the largest they ever achieved was around a little over 2,000.
And how did you divide them out?
They were divided out by patients were randomized. So they had a stress test that showed a large area of ischemia. Then they were randomized, meaning their treatment was selected by a computer. Either they received medical therapy alone or they received a stent.
And what was the bottom line? What did you find out?
By the way,
Mayo was part of this study, weren't you? You participated?
Right. Mayo was a part of the study. Out of the 5,000 patients, we contributed to 50 of the randomized patients worldwide. So we contributed a lot of patients compared to most other medical centers. So that was good for Mayo. Mm-hmm. But the major study findings were that outcomes, again, were the same between the two treatment groups. So the group of patients who received optimal medical therapy did as well in terms of survival and heart attack risk compared to patients who also received stents in addition to those treatments.
So that would suggest that we're overusing stents.
It sounds a little controversial there, Tom. And your hesitation is...
it's going to depend on who you talked about that. But I think I would word it as saying that the benefit of stents has probably been overstated, okay? There's still reasons to use stents. People can be on good medical therapy and they can have ongoing symptoms that aren't well controlled with the medication. And in that setting, the stents can help improve the symptoms. And stents are clearly beneficial for improving outcome in the setting of acute heart attack. But probably even the chronic settings, some who are going to be very critical of the profession would say they're probably being overused in the setting of chronic coronary disease.
But if you have the stents, you're still going to be instructed as the patient going forward then to go back to some of the traditional medical therapy that other group used that wasn't stented.
That's exactly right.
And so what are those precautions or going forward? What's that lifestyle?
Well, even if a patient who has chronic coronary artery disease gets a stent or not, the lifestyle measures, which are regular exercise and diet, are clearly the most beneficial for lowering risk when combined with correct medications. And the correct medications in patients with established coronary artery disease are aspirin. That recommendation no longer applies to the general public, but people who have established coronary artery disease should be on low-dose aspirin, and clearly they should be on a statin drug like Lipitor.
So that would be optimal medical therapy.
That's optimal medical therapy.
So just to make sure we understand, you had two groups of patients. One group, and all of them had ischemia, significant angina, chest pain and ischemia, meaning that part of their heart muscle was without a blood supply. And one group you gave optimal medical therapy, and you just described that. And the other group got either a stent or coronary artery bypass surgery, right?
Correct.
And after 3 years, there was no difference between the two groups with respect to what you call cardiovascular events. And that means death, myocardial infarction or heart attack, hospitalization for unstable angina, heart failure, cardiac arrest.
Absolutely right.
So bottom line is optimum medical therapy probably best for patients with stable angina and not a lot of chest pain.
Yes.
There was one thing I did read in the study, however, is that the patients in the second group who got either a stent or a coronary artery bypass surgery had less chest pain.
That's correct. So the quality of life indicators, both overall quality of life, how people rated how they were doing in general, as well as their angina frequency, were better in the group that got treated with stent or bypass surgery. But what you need to remember is that nobody was blinded to which treatment they were getting. They knew that they were getting stents or bypass surgery. And once people know that they're getting a certain treatment, there's a tremendous placebo effect from that treatment, and that could have influenced the quality of life results.
So if you think you're going to get better because of an intervention, you do.
That's saying it exactly correctly.
All right. The results of the ischemia trial are in, and conservative management of patients with stable angina seems to be just as good as invasive surgery, meaning treatment with a coronary artery stent or coronary artery bypass surgery, correct?
Correct.
Our thanks to Mayo Clinic cardiologist Dr. Todd Miller.
Okay. Thanks, Tracy. Thanks, Tom.
Breast cancer is the most common cancer in American women, except for skin cancer. Today, there are more than 3.5 million breast cancer survivors in the United States, and that includes women that are still being treated and those who have already been treated. Pretty amazing.
Survival rates for breast cancer are better than ever. That's great news. The number of women dying from breast cancer has dropped over 40% since 1989.
Wow.
However, as breast cancer survivors live longer, their risk of developing other serious medical conditions also increases. And joining us on the phone from Mayo Clinic in Arizona is medical oncologist, that's cancer specialist, Dr. Bassam Sonbal. Welcome to the program, Dr. Sonbal.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hey, Dr. Sonbal. So the good news, a lot of women in this country have survived breast cancer, some 3.5 million. And I think you recently studied a large group of survivors. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's right. So as you mentioned, really over the last specifically the 2 decades, we got much better in terms of the systemic therapy, and that include hormonal therapy and chemotherapy for these women. And in addition to that, improvement in surgical methods and radiation. That's why, I mean, we're at a point where I think about it like as a luxury, actually, that we're talking about discussing other causes of death besides breast cancer in those women who have the diagnosis. So a lot of women are now surviving more and more. And the question now that comes up, how are these women dying from their diagnosis? So what we did in this study, it's what we call a population-based study, so utilizing one of the databases that are available to look at a woman with a diagnosis of breast cancer. So we included almost three-quarter of a million, so 750,000 patients with breast cancer that were diagnosed between 2000 and 2015 with a retrospective study and looking, asking the question, what is the most common cause of death in these women? So,
these are all women who had no evidence of disease. They had been previously treated for breast cancer, and they were essentially cured.
Not necessarily. So they were diagnosed. We have the documentation that they were diagnosed, and then we're following along and seeing how are they dying. Are they dying from the breast cancer itself because it's recurred or never cured, or they're dying from other causes? Are they dying from heart problems or stroke or other things?
All right. And what'd you find out?
So we found out, actually, that, first of all, most of the death that happened are happening really in those women are between the year 1 and 5 from the diagnosis. And we found that the death from the breast cancer is going down as we go away from the diagnosis. By that, I mean within the first 5 years or first 10 years of diagnosis, most women... the most common cause of death is actually from the breast cancer. But then when we go away from that, so beyond 10 years of diagnosis, the breast cancer deaths are actually going down. So, for example, between year 5 and 10, the breast cancer itself was responsible for death for about a third of these patients. But then we have almost a third of these patients are dying from other diseases that are not really cancer, for example, heart disease and stroke. And then after 10 years of diagnosis, we have the most common cause of death in these women is actually non-breast cancer. So it's not really the breast cancer. Those women are dying from heart disease, COPD, Alzheimer's, stroke. So other causes that we really see in the general population itself. So,
are you able to tease out that the reason why after 10 years post-treatment, the heart disease or the Alzheimer's or the stroke, that those conditions were contributed to because of their cancer treatment? Or is that not the case?
That's a very good question. I think that's one of the limitations to this study and all other studies which are observational, we call them. I mean, we can look at associations, but we cannot specifically say that this is the causality or that this is what causes this. But we can hypothesize and really say, well, probably this is what happened, because one of the things we might say, well, I mean, those patients are dying from the heart problems, strokes, and things like that, like the general population. But what we did is to kind of delineate that whether they are at higher risk compared to the general population or not. We compared those women with women in the general population who do not have a breast cancer diagnosis in the past, and we found that actually, yeah, there is a higher risk for heart disease and stroke in those women. And to go back to your point, we do think in our team that probably some of those treatments that those women received helped them to kind of decrease the risk for dying from the disease itself, from the breast cancer, but maybe increased a little bit the risk for dying from heart disease and other things.
And so, do you think you can blame that on the chemotherapy in most instances? Because we haven't, at least up to this point, had targeted therapy where you were just treating the cancer. You treat the whole individual, which is what the term systemic means. So it damages not just the cancer in your breast, but other parts of your body.
Right. So that's in part due to the chemotherapy, because over the last 2 decades, I mean, we just not have just newer therapy. What we also have, we learned more about the therapies that we already know about. By that, I mean we know how to optimize therapy. We know that for some women, less is actually better and is not harmful. So we know, for example, anthracyclines, some of the chemotherapies that we've been utilizing in those patients, known as, and some women call them as the red devil, because it's kind of look reddish chemotherapy. So that chemotherapy, for example, is associated with a higher risk of heart problems. So that's why right now we know that in a lot of those women, we don't really need that anthracycline. We can utilize other drugs. Anthracycline is needed for specific population of women. And then, so that's systemic therapy or chemotherapy. And also we learned, for example, about targeted therapy and how to utilize it better. For example, the Herceptin is one of the directed therapies or targeted therapies. We know that it is associated with some heart problems. In addition to that, we know that for radiation, we now know that there were multiple studies looking at how less might be better for those women, because we know that radiating the left breast is associated with a risk of heart problems at the long run. And there have been some studies right now asking the question, well, can we decrease the radiation from, for example, 5 weeks to less radiation? It's called hypofractionation, which is about 3 weeks of radiation. And in some women, yes, we can do that. And in addition to that, for example, utilizing better techniques, for example, in Mayo Clinic, we have the proton beam radiation instead of photon. So that's kind of more targeted, not really causing more problems to the heart. So all of these things really play into the decision process.
So still the most common cause of death 10 years after diagnosis is due to the breast cancer.
After 10 years? No,
it's actually...
Up until 10 years, yes, it is true.
And then after 10 years, a higher risk of death from Alzheimer's, heart disease, and non-breast cancers.
Exactly.
Dr. Bassam Sanbal, more women than ever have survived breast cancer, but those women are at increased risk for other serious medical conditions. And it's important information for not only women who have had breast cancer, but also their healthcare providers. Dr. Sanbal, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that's our program for this week.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our producer for the program is Jennifer O'Hara. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Thanks for joining us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, newsnetwork.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.